bit smaller on everybody.
Right, year by year, right? That's what happens. Okay, so our next mitzvah. It's actually interesting, in the count of mitzvos, it's sort of out of order. Meaning, as we go through the Chumash, we're in Devarim chapter 21, and really this should be, in terms of our count, we're in the 500s. But actually, when the commentators that count mitzvahs count this mitzvah, they actually count it as number 248. And that's just because there's one line earlier in the Torah that refers to this, but the main description is over here. So we reserve it to discuss right now, but the official count is number 248. But definitely the Torah appears way towards the end. And this mitzvah is how to deal with a ben soror umora, which is an extremely rebellious child.
This doesn't have anything to do with your count.
No, I sure hope not. I sure hope not.
This sounds interesting.
So, excuse me. He's a rebellious child to the point where he is deemed hopeless and executed. That's how bad it is. Ben Soror Umora, as we call it. Just to follow from last week's discussion, last week we discussed the Eishes Yefas Toar, the soldier who finds a woman in battle who's attracted to and marries her. So Rashi tells us, and the sages describe, that a marriage that begins in that manner may lead to a rebellious child, because if the marriage doesn't have that harmony within, the kids aren't going to take necessarily the message from the parents. So there's a connection between these two. But ultimately, this child is somebody who is so corrupt on the inside, they're beyond repair. To the point where we say this kid's unredeemable, and the only hope we have is to execute him. So it sounds very extreme. However, the Gemara tells us it never happened, it never will happen. It's a mitzvah in the Torah, it's there, the rules are on the books, but it's totally conceptual, because there's no such thing. There's no such thing as a child amongst the Jewish people that is unredeemable. Every kid has hope. There's a spark of good within every single person. And we'll see when it comes to the details of this mitzvah, the details are so precise and they're so abundant, there's no way we could ever match up to them and actually carry through with this punishment. So on the one hand, this is something which is somewhat academic in terms of the practical analysis of it. Practically, it will never happen, the Gemara says. But we do learn from it a lot. And the Gemara says, so if it ever could happen, why does the Torah talk about it? I mean, if it can't happen, if it's impossible, so why is it in the Torah? So the Gemara says, Josh v'kabel schar, you should learn from it and get reward. So there's messages that are found in this discussion, which are very, very important messages. However, putting it all together to practically carry out the punishment of Ben Soror Umora isn't going to happen. So we have to realize that parts of the Torah sometimes aren't meant to be practical for us, but they're meant to be to teach us lessons. They're there to teach us, but not for practical application. So this is one of those cases where Rav Hirsch says it's a source of pedagogical truth, right? Pedagogical truth, but it's not meant to be practical in terms of executing a kid. That's what Rav Hirsch says. So, but the details are very precise, they're very abundant, and it's extremely unlikely they could ever come together to actually occur in the practical world. So but let's put it into context, though, because the way that we understand this is that these details, what they're doing, is they're trying to show that every single other avenue of attempt has been made to help this kid improve himself, and despite that, he's still carrying on his rebellious ways. I mean, we can't blame the parents, we can't blame society, we're trying to prove the kid is rotten on the inside, and that's why he's acting in this way. Which again doesn't happen because no kid is absolutely rotten. Everybody has good within them. That's why it's not practical. But we're trying to rule out other reasons why he's doing what he's doing. If there's other excuses, then we can't execute the kid because there's hope. It's only because the kid is utterly hopeless is he executed. He's deemed incurable, as it were. Rotten beyond repair. Now the way that the rabbis describe this mitzvah of killing this kid, and they actually describe it as for his benefit. The sages say, Ben Soror Umora nidon al shem sofo. He's judged based on his destiny, on his fate. Let him die innocent and not die guilty. Meaning, if you left him around as is, he will result in being a murderer, an bandit, a terrible person who is a damage to society around him. And that's the Torah has deemed that's his destiny. And therefore, let's kill him now while he's still innocent, while he's just a kid, and not let him bring his life to the extent where he will be a murderous, terrible person. And it's the ability to see, based on his current actions, to be able to project where is he going with this. And again, and that projectile is, we're saying, is incurable. He's for sure going there because we've seen what he does right now, and there's no way out of it. And that's the context of this mitzvah. excuse me. What this means is that the parents did everything they could. If you could say, oh, he had terrible parents, so it's not his fault. If you could say the parents were giving him mixed messages, okay, so deep down there's something good in the child, but he got misled along the way. But if the kid is acting in this way, and we'll see what he does, and he's still exhibiting these traits, and the parents cannot be put at fault because we look at them and they seem to be perfect parents, and society around them can't be faulted because you know, all the different factors around have matched up, therefore it has to be the kid is rotten. So that's what the halachas are trying to point at. You know, Rav Hirsch has a long essay on this. And the way that Rav Hirsch describes it, like I was saying, but I just want to bring out his words. Rav Hirsch says that what comes out of all these details of this mitzvah are the idea they should kill the ben sora umore in the case where all of his, we'll see, his gluttony and his drunkenness, they're there to expose the corruption of the absolute corruption of his soul and his entire lack of ability to control himself and acting as an animal. And with this, the judges see that they can't fault his education, they can't fault external factors. It has to be that he is at fault from the inside. That's what we're trying to get at. Only in this situation can a Beis Din actually say this kid is totally rotten, he has no chance to improve, and he'll never ever find his way, even with other guides and mentors and inspirations, because everything's been tried on this kid and done perfectly, and he still is corrupt. So again, that statement is impossible. I mean, how can we ever say everything's been done, and he's still, again, it doesn't happen. This can't happen, it doesn't happen. But that's the context the Torah is putting it in. So I want to go through again, let's go through the details of how the mitzvah works, and we'll explain each point. Yeah?
How do you fulfill this mitzvah? By doing what it says to do? I mean, I'm just like the Tariq mitzvah.
Well, by learning about it. And then, you can fulfill certain details in terms of how you educate your kids, how you conduct yourself. Just putting it all together as one to execute the kid's not going to happen. But the details, that's what it says. Joshua Kabbalah Skar, learn it and get reward for learning it, but you're not going to actually be able to carry it out practically. So I want to go through these details, you know, one by one, and then we'll try to explain them all. Before we get to the details, let's just understand the term. He's called a ben sorer umore, is the term the Torah uses. So the word sorer, Rashi says, comes from the word sar min haderech. He has veered off of the path. Meaning that he's going against the expectations. Now he's trying to forge his own way. So there's a certain expectation on him from his parents, from society. And he's chosen, I'm going to go my own path. So that itself is not all that bad. Some kids, they want to try to find their own path. It's not necessarily a bad thing. But the problem is the next part, he's more. Not only does he go on his own path, more means he's rebellious, meaning that he explicitly defies authority. So many of us might try to find our own path, and then someone tells us, you know, it's not a good idea. You know, a parent, a friend, a mentor, someone tells you, you know, I don't think you're going on the right path. So you're willing to listen, because you're not a rebellious person, you're just trying to find your way in life. So the kid was trying to find his way, that's not so terrible. But he's more, he rebels against authority, his parents, his teachers, and the rebelliousness makes him hopeless. The Sforno explains further. He says that it's the rebelliousness that removes all hope from the kid. Because if you're not rebellious, you're just searching, okay, so eventually maybe you'll come back to the right path, because you're not trying to define anybody, you're just trying to figure things out on your own. But if your attitude is, I'm straying off, and I'm a rebellious person, that makes you hopeless, because then nobody can bring you back on the right path. And that's really where the true problem lies in this kid. The Hamik Dover, the Netziv, in his parish in the Torah, in his explanation, he says that the word sorer refers to defying the father. The father's job is to teach the kid Torah, and the word sorer will be that he goes against the father's lessons. The word mora refers to defying the mother. The mother might teach the kid manners, derech eretz, how to act properly in life, how to treat each other, you know, things which are more interpersonal relationship type ideas. And the fact he rebels against that, so he's going against both the messages of the Torah, and also just against acting as a mensch in society. It goes both ways. He's lacking derech eretz, he does not have a mensch, he's also lacking his ability to understand the Torah. So he has neither. He has neither respect for Torah, nor for acting as a proper human being. But both of those things he rebels against. So Sorer is against the father's lessons, and Mora is against the mother's lessons.
He's not bar mitzvah yet, right? I mean, this is still the
age. He's just bar mitzvah. We'll get to the age soon. He's just bar mitzvah we're talking about.
Okay.
If he's younger, we can't hold him accountable. He's too young to be held accountable.
Okay.
Right? So we'll see the age soon. So let's go through those details. That's a good point to bring those details in. So just to go through some details, then we'll discuss why they are as they are. So number one, the age. So it's described in the Mishnah, and I'm really quoting from the Rambam here, that it only, this the window of opportunity, as it were, to execute this kid is only 3 months. It's from when he begins the age of maturity, begins puberty, bar mitzvah, we'll call that bar mitzvah and onwards, for 3 months after. That's what's described. So he's just maturing, this kid. Let's call him his bar mitzvah age, and then 3 months pass. That's the window of time that if he does these actions, we deem him incurable. That's one fact. Let's go through the facts, then we'll discuss them. What does he do? So the Torah describes that he's zolel v'sove, which is described, translated, as he's acting as a glutton and a drunkard. So what does it mean, as a glutton and a drunkard? Like gorging and guzzling down wine without any shame. But it means we'll discuss more what he eats and drinks. But it means that we catch him eating and drinking in a very, very animalistic way. What is that? So the halacha says it has to be he stole money from his father, and then he goes out and he buys low-quality meat and low-quality wine. So it can't be the good stuff. It's got to be the low-quality stuff. He then eats it and drinks it outside his parents' property, not at home, but somewhere else. He does it with a group of friends who are also lowlifes and, you know, not great people. The meat has to be meat which is only partially cooked. Can't be raw and can't be fully cooked. So the details I told you, you can't fulfill the details here. The wine is only partially diluted. In their days, wine was very, very strong, and they always diluted their wine in order so it was drinkable. So if he diluted it totally, or if he didn't dilute it, then he's not executed. It has to be he diluted it partially. Also, he has to eat a certain quantity of it, you know, in one bite, in one sitting. So all those details have to come together.
So that's kosher meat?
It has to be kosher meat, but it can't be in a mitzvah setting. That's another detail. So for instance, if he's having it, let's say, I don't know, let's call it like for a Shabbos meal, right? That's a mitzvah setting. He's not executed for that. If he's having it, you know, if he's eating, let's say, meat of a sacrifice, which is a mitzvah, even in this manner, he's not executed for that. So it has to be, but also if it's non-kosher, he's also not executed. It has to be kosher food, but eaten in a normal manner, not in a mitzvah manner, and not in a manner which is an aveiro. If he eats on a fast day also, he's not executed. So he's eating a normal everyday meal of kosher food. Again, lots and lots of details here. So that's what the kid does. Now beyond that, the parents have to have a certain quality of parenting. Meaning number one,
Not much.
Well, that's the thing. They're good parents, but the kid's still like this. That's the whole point. They're good parents, but the kid's still like this. So if the parents themselves, there is a concept they should have similar voices, which is interesting. We'll talk about that. The parents can't be disabled in any way. If the parents are blind or deaf or in some other way disabled, that's going to disqualify the kid. That's going to exempt him from execution. There's even an opinion that the parents have to have similar heights and appearance, which is getting even more unlikely to ever actually happen. The child is then brought, when he's caught the first time eating and drinking in this manner, he's brought to the Beis Din, and he is given lashes for his actions. There has to be witnesses and everything too. So there's witnesses that saw him steal from his father, take the money, buy the food in this manner, eat it with this group of friends, and you know, the way it's partially cooked, etc. And these witnesses are able to come testify in the Beis Din. Yeah.
This has raw requires also.
Yeah. Anytime you're going to punish me, that has to be a warning. They take him to the Beis Din of three. You need a three-man Beis Din for this. And they give him lashes. And they say, don't do it again. If he does this all again, they take him to a 23-man Beis Din and they execute him there. So that's the process. So you see why it really will never happen, it never could happen. And beyond that, the parents have to agree to this process. So the parents have to agree to have their kid executed. I mean, the parents have given up, basically. If either parent objects, then they don't execute the kid. So, as we said, it never was, never will be. The details, there's too many, too precise, and too far out to happen. And that's why we say this whole mitzvah is really just academic, we'll call it conceptual, but can't happen in the world of reality. So if that's the case, we have to learn the lessons here. So what are the lessons you gain from it? Because it's not just a useless information. Obviously, when Hashem puts it in the Torah, there are lessons to be gained from every single detail. And why are these the details? So again, rebellious in a kid is natural. I mean, we know teenagers are rebellious. That's a natural result of becoming a teenager. And everyone knows that from life experience, from themselves, from their kids, everyone knows that. The question is what the kid is doing right now a natural expression of their teenage rebelliousness? Or is the kid really a lost cause? And for most kids, 99.9999%, it's just natural. And kids, you know, they mature, they grow out of it, everyone's rebellious in their own ways, and then they get past it. This kid, every single detail that we have in this mitzvah, if they all fall into place, it shows this kid really is not just a typical rebellious teenager, but like we said before, he's rotten at the core. And he's incurable. So he can't be redeemed. So let's just go through some of these points. So we discussed the age. Because we age just when he's physically maturing for 3 months. Those first 3 months. So why is that the age? So if the kid is younger, obviously, we say the kid is still an immature kid. No, he's not accountable for his actions. No, he's a baby. So obviously, in that case, we're not going to execute him. If the kid is older, that means that, you know, in his first few months developing as an adult, he didn't exhibit his terrible traits. You know, he didn't go to these extremes. So that shows us that, okay, so there's something in him which isn't rotten at the core. But the moment a kid is just maturing into an adult, and during those, you know, few precious months, he's exhibiting these terribly rebellious traits, acting as an animal, defying everything around him. So that shows us that there's something about that kid at the core which is a problem. So it teaches us that this time in a kid's life is so critical. We talk about what are critical years to educate a child in our own lives. So it could be that those critical years are really just those years right there. Just as the kid is becoming mature, just as they reach Bar Bas Mitzvah age, those months are so precious because the kid is just starting to become an adult. And what are the impressions the kid has at those moments? The child's maturity is just awakening. This is a time when they have to start exhibiting some drive to be an upstanding individual, some drive to have self-control. So during those months, there's a parent's window to really educate a child, and it's a window into the child themselves. They're just starting on their path, and no one's a finished product ever. I mean, 120 years are still not finished products. But at least you want to see just some glimpse at those moments of somebody who can handle life as a mature adult. And if that glimpse is not there, that's a bad sign, a very bad sign. And you want to see the good in some way, you know, breaks through in the child's new stage of maturity. If we see at that stage, there's no control, there's no obedience, there's no sense of good. So it's a sign about the kid's emptiness and then what's to come in the future. So that's why that age is so important. But if they only exhibit these things past that age or before that age, that's not a sign that it's at the core. That's a sign that it's other things, which are other factors which are involved. Beyond that, so what does the child do? What do we see? We don't see the child murdering. We don't see the child, you know, necessarily doing terrible things. Typically, a lot of us might eat, you know, or drink without control one time or another, and obviously it's not an executable offense. That's not so bad. Everyone might, you know, eat too much one time. That's not the problem. The idea of zolo v'sove. So zolo v'sove is that, you know, you're acting as a glutton, as a drunkard. Again, Rav Hirsch explains without any embarrassment. You know, the kid is drinking and drunk, and there's no embarrassment to it at all. But what are all these details? We said it's a steal from parents. So stealing from the parents, obviously, is an act of terrible defiance. It shows you see no value in what your parents do for you. You're willing just to take their money, steal, and do what you want with it. So that's certainly a sign of defiance. We said the child has to buy cheap meat and cheap wine. It has to be the inferior quality stuff. Not nice meat, not high quality wine. So why would that be? So I think there's really 2 points to this. Let's say the child has, we'll call them, you know, more refined tastes. So then you also see, deep in the child, you know, there's some sense of refinement. You know, the child has some sense of, even when it comes to taste for food, you know, there is a sense that, okay, there's something more special about this versus that. I don't think that animals really differentiate between, you know, what kind of meat they eat. This meat, they eat it. Could be their preferences. You know, they'd rather eat the deer over the antelope or something. I don't know. But ultimately, I don't think animals have that differentiation of this is very, very fine meat, this is very inferior quality meat. Human beings, you know, there's a sense of refinement in a person that does appreciate finer foods. And we recognize that it's considered cultured. It's considered a little bit, you know, beyond. People who their entire diet is upon McDonald's french fries and hamburgers, we view that as a little bit different in terms of society than somebody whose diet consists of, you know, more refined, more cultured foods. So the kid's only interest is in the cheap foods, so that also is a lack of refinement. And then furthermore, the Rambam says that if it's only cheap meats and cheap wine, that shows the habit something that he plans to sustain. If it's a one-time thing, and one time I found a lot of money, and I really want to go and enjoy a great meal of really, really beautiful wine and a delicious steak, does that mean the child's planning to maintain this habit for a lifetime? It's not going to be sustainable because he's trying to buy the expensive stuff. But we're trying to show that, no, he's going a certain path. The path will continue. If that path begins with he's being careful only buying the inferior quality stuff, because he says, I want to do this again and again and again, that's a sign for us that it does plan to continue. So he's consuming it.
He's thrifty.
It's not he's thrifty. But it shows us that he wants to be thrifty because he wants to be able to keep it going. That's what we're saying. He wants to keep it going. So that's one point. He consumes it with friends, which are, as it's described in the halacha, rekanim apchusin. They are empty, lowly people. No inferior quality. For his friends are lowlifes just like him. Also no good. So obviously we can understand that. You know, friends are a big influence upon us. Whether you're a kid or an adult, you know, friends are a big influence upon a person. You know, if his friends were good, even if he's acting in this manner, we say, okay, he has hope. Because even though he may not associate with his parents and listen to them, but his friends will hope to give, you know, be a positive influence upon him and bring him back to the right path. That's the hope. But if we see that not only does he have terrible friends, but they're willing also to eat in this manner with him, with stolen goods, so that shows us his influences around him also, you know, they're not going to get him anywhere. He's hopeless in terms of his friends, and he's hopeless in terms of his own personal conduct. So that's the idea of if he had a good friend, if he was able to have good friends around him, we would say the kid has a hope. So that shows us also the importance of good friends. Whether a kid or an adult, we have to have friends who are positive influences upon us, not who are going to draw us in the wrong direction. So number one, he consumes it in that manner. It's cheap, it's inferior, the habit will continue. Number two, he has to eat it with his friends who are lowlifes, you know, his friends who are also lowly. We say it has to be consumed in a way which it's partially cooked and partially diluted. So I don't have a great explanation of that, but to me it seems to sound like it's also sort of animalistic type of eating. Now, if he was concerned, he'd have the patience to wait till it's fully cooked. So it shows also like there's something he appreciates about good food, and maybe there's something in him which is a little bit more refined. If he eats it raw, so again, that's not sustainable. That shows like a one-time rebellious act, but that's weird. No one eats things. It's not a lifetime eating raw meat. That'd be strange. And the undiluted wine is like, you know, a college kid having a dare. Can you really drink that much? You know, but that's not sustainable. That's not continue onwards. But if he drinks his wine in a way which is partially diluted, so it's drinkable, and it could be sustained, and he eats his meat partially cooked, so it's cooked enough that he can sustain the habit, but he's animalistic in that he doesn't really care to cook it properly. So that's also showing that he himself conducts himself like an animal. That's also pointing to that.
But the wine, could it be that it shows he's drinking it strictly for the intoxicating effect?
Because he doesn't dilute it enough. It could be. He's looking to get drunk. Yeah, that could definitely be. So it's actually very interesting because the Gemara discusses, you know, one of the halachas in terms of cooking on Shabbos is relevant to a level of cooking called Meichel Ben Drusai. That term refers to a thief whose name is Ben Drusai. And this thief, he would only cook his food partially because it was on the run. He didn't have time to sit there and wait for it to finish up in the pot because he had to run away from the cops. So anytime he'd cook his food, you know, he'd put it on, he'd, okay, it's good enough, he'd eat it and he'd run away. So in Hilchos Shabbos, when we discuss the idea of what's called cooking, what's called not cooking, there's ramifications halachically for this. There's a level of cooking called Meichel Ben Drusai, and that's partially cooked. So this kid is acting like the thief. You know, he's partially cooking his food. He's getting used to a life as a thief, basically. He's accustoming himself to eating partially cooked food. So definitely is reminiscent of that. So that's the idea of partially cooked food. Now, if he eats it in a mitzvah situation, so let's say he eats it, as we said, he eats meat from a sacrifice. That means he stole the money and bought it, but stolen money, made meat from a sacrifice. Or let's say he's eating it in the context of a Yom Tov meal, a Purim Suda. Or he's eating it in the context of, let's say, a siyum. You know, so he's doing something which we would call a mitzvah. In that case, he's not executed, even though it's stolen goods, and he ate it partially cooked, and all the other factors are there. Because if it's in the context of mitzvah, again, there's something redeemable about that. You know, you could say, deep down, he wanted to do the right thing, and even two wrongs don't make a right, but ultimately he was trying to do a mitzvah, and, you know, so there shows there's something to him. So it can't be a mitzvah situation. The mitzvah has some good in it. Now, the other thing's interesting. It also can't be a food which is forbidden to eat. If he steals money and buys pork chops, or buys crab cakes. A good Marylander, he buys crab cakes. So he's also executed for that. I mean, obviously, he needs to be eating kosher food, and he'll have to suffer those consequences. But he's not a ben Soramura for doing that. So the reason that's given for this idea is the pasuk says, "Einenu shomea bekoleinu." The parents come to the Beis Din, and they say that the kid doesn't listen to our voice. Don't listen to our voice. So, meaning that he's listening to God, but not to us. We're looking for the kid to show his defiance towards authority in this world, even if he happens to be listening to God at the time. Because if what he's doing, let's say, is he's eating a pork chop or he's eating a crab cake. So at that point, it's showing what he's doing could be a religious rebellion. I mean, a kid who rebels against religion also doesn't show he's rotten at the core. Many, many people, for every reason, are not religious, or may rebel against their religion of birth, but doesn't show they're terrible people. It could be a good person who has an issue with religion. So it doesn't deem the kid as unredeemable. It doesn't show the kid cannot make it in this world. It doesn't mean that. So if we see him eating a pork chop, we say, you know, maybe he's rebelling against the religion of his youth. Maybe he wants to defy the Torah. But yet he could still be an upstanding member of society. He could be a good person. He could have a good marriage. He's not going to be abandoned. But if we see, well, he's even eating kosher food, but he's just trying to spite his parents, to us it's a much, much worse gesture. And the truth, this really speaks to the idea of Derech Eretz Kamel Torah. We know that Derech Eretz, acting as a mensch, is the prerequisite for Torah. I mean, if somebody's able to act as an upstanding human being, but yet they don't quite perform the mitzvos. So we say this person's a good person, but they have to increase their observance of Torah. If somebody is keeping mitzvos, but is a rotten human being, we say the person is a hypocrite and a terrible person. That's how we view it. That's because Derech Eretz has to come first. The Torah is on the platform of Derech Eretz. If the Derech Eretz is not there, that's a much deeper problem than the Torah not being there. So if the kid displays he's rebelling against the Torah, we say, okay, maybe he's an okay kid who has an issue with religion. If the kid displays I'm rebelling against my parents only, but my meat's not kosher, then we say the kid is a rotten kid. And that's a deeper problem. So it can't be mitzvah food, and it can't be forbidden food. It has to be regular everyday food that's kosher, but in a context of regular meals, not a context of a mitzvah meal. Both parents must agree to have him executed. Another detail, which is extremely unlikely. What's this idea? So if they both agree to have him executed, so that means they both have given up hope. If they say, please don't kill the kid, they're saying that, you know, we still think there's something in this kid that we love, we appreciate, and therefore we can kind of coax it out. But if both parents give up on the kid, then usually that shows, you know, for a parent to give up on a kid takes a lot. That means the parents have been driven to their extreme, and they just, you know, it's nearly impossible in our minds to see you give up on a child. But if the parents have given up on the child, both of them, the father and the mother, so that also shows how incurable this child actually is. If the parents are disabled in some way, let's say the parents are blind, deaf, you know, can't walk, etc., it also doesn't qualify for Minsara Mora. Why? Because you'll say that the parents weren't able to get across the message properly. Let's say one of the parents is deaf. So the communication with the kid may have been difficult. So the parents are trying to teach the kids lessons, but they couldn't communicate well. So that indicates not that the kid is corrupt in his essence, it indicates the parents that it has a difficulty in parenting. Say the parents are blind. If one of the parents is blind, so it could be that they weren't able to see the kid for his positive traits. Could be the communication was also off. You couldn't look at each other in the eye. You couldn't see each other. So in that case, we could put some blame on the parenting, not on the kid, and say the kid just didn't get the message from the parents properly. But the kid actually has a possible redeemable quality within him, so we execute him. Even if the parents are disabled in some other way, you can say that they weren't able to get the message to the kid in a way that other parents could, with body language. I mean, you have to be able to get the message across clearly from both parents, and still the kid rebels. When it says that the parents have to have similar voices, so luckily that might mean they have to sound similar. But Rav Hirsch explains, at least conceptually, what it means is that they have to have a similar message. When kids hear mixed messages from their parents, it's very hard for kids. You know, daddy says one thing, mommy says another thing. So the kid gets confused, and that also leads to a rebellion, because they don't know what to do. They don't know what's right or wrong, and they say, both my parents then are crazy, and I gotta do my own thing. So in a case like that, you blame the parents, to some degree, that the kid's acting as he is, and not the kid. But the parents are giving across together the same message in the same way, you know, with a good relationship and good communication, and the kid still rebels. Then you say the parents did a good job, it's the kid's fault. And again, only Hashem could say such a thing. But that's what the halacha, if all these pieces fell into place, the halacha would dictate, Hashem has now said this kid is at fault, not the parents. Very often, the parents are at fault. You know, the parents aren't perfect either. You know, we try our best, but we're not perfect. So the idea of having a similar voice, at least conceptually, is there has to be a consistent message. The opinion of the Gemara that says they have to have similar height or similar appearance, it also that the parents might impress opinions on a child differently. Let's say one parent is very, very big and powerful, and one is very small and scrawny. So they might speak to the kid in different ways. The kid also might get confused. What's priorities? What's not priorities? What does my father really value? What does my mother really value? Because they're not coming across in the same way. But they come across in this. So mixed messages are always a terrible thing in parenting. You want to be sure that you're on the same page in what message you give your child. So that's the idea of having both parents agree and having the parents have these similarities. Now there's a comment made by Rabbeinu Bachaya, one of the great Rishonim, early commentators in the Torah, and he actually says, if parents were to carry through with this entire process and agree to have their kid killed, he says they're acting on the level of Avraham at the Akedah, which is a fascinating thing. Avraham said, I'm going to sacrifice my son for the will of Hashem. And if parents really are willing to go through this process, and they say, we're going to agree to have the execution happen, they're saying, you know, the Torah has told me this is what has to be done to my child, and therefore I'm willing to sacrifice my child because Hashem has deemed it to be appropriate. So they've actually achieved something on the level of Abraham's greatness. Again, this never happened, so the parent has never actually had the opportunity to achieve this. But he says that the idea of Ben Sora Mora is sacrificing what's most dear to us for the honor of God. You know, God says that it's a very, very difficult thing to do, but this kid is not good for society. You have to get rid of him. And that would be like Hashem telling Avraham, sacrifice Yitzchak. This is the same type of attitude. And Rabbeinu Bachaya says that there's a certain notion, which you see over here, that the love of Hashem ideally tops all. You know, the love of other human beings is something which to us is so difficult to ever overcome for any other purpose. Rabbeinu Bachaya says, from the Akedah, that's the lesson you get from Avraham Avinu, and from this mitzvah, if the parents did carry through with this, they'd be showing the love of Hashem tops the love of our children. This would be something which is very difficult for anybody to ever really feel that way. It's extremely high level, like Avraham's level. But that's what would happen if this actually did carry through. So again, it can't happen, never will happen. But that's if a parent to let this happen would be that they're telling themselves that I'm sacrificing my kid for the sake of God. And a very, very powerful thing. So what happens now? So everything's in place, right? The parents have similar voices and similar appearance, similar height, both of them. Neither are disabled. They give across a message to the kid, etc. He eats the meat, drinks the wine, as we have described. So they bring him to the Beis Din of three judges. And there's enough witnesses, you know, who've seen all the different parts. They're giving him warning and testifying the Beis Din that he's done as we've described. So they give the kid lashes. Right? The typical punishment of lashes, 39 lashes. So he did it once, and he got lashed. Now, if a kid can go through all this, and get lashed, and then do it again, that shows how corrupt he is. I mean, one time's not enough. One time we'll say, okay, the kid's just rebellious, you know, he's just a kid, he's immature, he's a teenager, and then he write it off. And lashes are very painful. 39 lashes with a strand of with a leather whip. It was a painful punishment. And the kid, he endured it all. And then he did not heed the warning, and he went through it again. I would add in that when he went to the Beis Din, I'm sure that the judges in the Beis Din spoke to him, tried to encourage him, tried to persuade him to improve himself. It wasn't just, okay, here's your lashes, you get out of here.
Is it the parents who are doing the
No, it was done by the Beis Din. The Beis Din did it, not the parents, yeah.
Okay.
The Beis Din did it. But the interaction with the judge and the Beis Din, I also should be a positive influence on the kid. You know, these were great tzaddikim, they should try to influence him to good. And despite all of that, despite the urging, and despite the lashes, and despite the embarrassments, everything he's been through, he still does it all again. He goes back and steals from his parents again, and he goes buys the meat and drinks the wine again. Everything we've said, if that all comes into place a second time, so then he's brought before a 23-man Beis Din, and he is executed. So that's what happens. So we see how far off this kid has to be for this to actually occur. The execution is publicized. The Torah says that everybody should hear about this. They would send out notices to the entire land that we were executing a Ben Sora Amora. And the idea is obvious, that there's lessons to be learned from this. The kids should realize, don't get involved in these kind of actions. Stay away.
This is
Skila? Skila. It's the most severe of all the executions. And the Netziv describes, you know, even adults who are already past the age of Ben Sora Amora, they still should take lessons about the pitfalls of a lifestyle of theft and indulgence, because even though they may not be to the extreme of this kid, but we understand that living a lifestyle like that can bring you to no good. So the message has to be publicized throughout the land to kids and adults alike, that anybody could fall into such a trap. Anybody could lose control over their own personal desires, fall into a group of bad friends, stealing, gorging, and, you know, becoming drunk and food and drink. Anybody can fall into that lifestyle. And he cites the pasuk which is said in Parshas Hazinu, "Vishman yeshun vayivat." The Jewish people will become fat and rebel. "Shemanta visa kasisa." It's because you've become so involved in your own personal pleasure, your gluttonous enjoyments, indulgence, that causes the rebellion. So this kid, you know, he's stealing money to enjoy himself with food and drink. That's a lifestyle we all have to avoid. So this is the picture of Ben Sora Amora. We see why it can never happen, but we see the lessons of parenting and of self-conduct that you learn from it. And that's the point. When the Torah says, Drosh v'kabel schar, the Gemara says, well, you should expound upon this, and you should achieve reward, you should receive reward for it. So the reward, of course, is for Torah study, but beyond that, the reward is in your own personal conduct. You can learn how to act as a good parent, how to deal with messages in society around you, and what kind of lifestyle. Yeah.
There's no mention. What if the child is sick? Bipolar, autism?
It's
no
interesting.
Mention.
Interesting.
That route.
I don't know.
You know?
Based on what we've said, it sounds like it should get him off the hook, but I don't know. It's not mentioned. You're right. I mean, it happens to be, you know, in the times of the Gemara, in the times of the Torah, these things weren't really diagnosed. So either, I mean, you might be sane or insane as far as it went,
right.
But there was no idea of saying, well, he's bipolar.
Oh,
or he's,
I know that.
You know,
right.
So
right.
It's not something to discuss. You would think nowadays, as we can define a condition, we could say maybe it's not his fault, maybe there's something else there. But I don't know. I'm not sure what would happen. Again, it's not relevant practically, but in our minds, I guess that's something to take into account. You look at a child, you say, this child is rotten to the core. And we say, no, you know, he has an emotional struggle within.
Right, okay.
He has a mental struggle within, and he can't control himself. So therefore, he's not rotten at the core. I think it fits into the message we're saying over here. And no kid, you can't judge a kid this severely, because there's so many factors involved that
right.
might dictate their actions.
Exactly.
And that's why the rabbis say it will never happen, because, again, no kid is rotten at the core. There's always something good, and there's other things that might sway them one way or the other. I think it's a very valid point. But this idea of just having a section of the Torah which is just, again, academic, just conceptual. So number one, it shows us the idea of Torah study itself does achieve a reward, even if it's not practical. It's something that, let's say, very often, you know, I speak to the boys in yeshiva, and a lot of what we study in yeshiva is not practical. A lot of it's just something that remains. If you become a judge on a base, then maybe it'll be practical, maybe not. But Torah study is not only about being practical. It's about gaining the lessons from the concepts which are there, even if they may not actually happen in the real world. That's one point. And ultimately, we've seen here that the messages are certainly practical messages. So to piece them all together one by one and say, okay, therefore we're executing a kid, that doesn't happen. But each detail has taught us something. You know, each detail of this description, of this process, of this procedure, every detail which is there, contained within it, you know, some message in terms of ourselves. And I think it's important we look at the Torah overall. Often we'll study the Torah, and we'll get to sections, we say, well, that's not practical. For many reasons. Either because, let's say, there's no Beis HaMikdash, or because I'll never do that, I'll never go there, I'll never be that person. Or you say these are details of history that, you know, that are long gone and not relevant to me. And the answer is, in the practical world, that might be true, but on the conceptual level, there's always something to take out of it. In our job, as we study the Torah, is always to say, okay, even though practically I cannot perform what it says over here, what's the message of this idea? Now, we've done in this class many, many mitzvos that are not practical nowadays, but there's always a message to it. So this mitzvah, I think, is held up sort of as a model, that this one is said in the Gemara as totally conceptual, and not practical, and despite that, we still have plenty to learn from it.
What number was this?
So I said in the beginning that 48. We're out of order. I mean, it's 248 officially, even though it's the Torah much later. So, I mean, last week we did 530. But this is listed by those who count mitzvahs as 248, because there's one line earlier in the Torah, which is relevant to this mitzvah, which they count that line instead of where it says it over here. So that's for technical reasons. So that's the idea of Ensor Amora. Any questions?
Thank you, Rabbi.
Okay. I wish everyone a wonderful summer.